Welcome back to the Cowbell Fever podcast. This episode was planned for a while, and it was going to be the first of the season, but then we wound up talking to Ben Pop, so it got a bit out of order. You should go listen to that just a few days ago. It was recorded about a week ago. It's not quite as cold in Duluth as it was when we did record it, but most of the rest of the episode should hold up. Now, I've been skiing the Berkey since 2006, and so has Jacob Wortman. We started together in Wave 2 that year. He made it in the Elite Wave, took me a couple more years. He has missed one race since then, so he's one behind. I think he's been on every Main Street podcast, but I never really wanted this podcast, aside from Main Street, to just be where I just talk to my friends. But then he went off and won the Superior 100-mile race. So when my friends do impressive stuff, well, I can shoot the ball with them for a while. Whether you're an ultra racer or not, it's good Berkey training though, should probably try it. I think you'll enjoy the episode. I did, twice. Due to a miscommunication, we wound up with audio only for the first half of the conversation. But because Jacob is a stand-up guy, and because his kids were asleep, we gave it another go and get a tighter, more coherent podcast. It's a good reminder to me to write down an outline, and winds up being a better product for listeners. Speaking of great products, we've once again partnered with Pioneer Midwest, which is now a presenting sponsor of the Berkey, to promote their race wax service. As I've said many times on this podcast, having someone else wax your skis makes your pre-Berkey routine and stress level that much lower. No need to lug your wax setup to a cabin, hope you have the right wax, or hope that you can get to New Moon or Riverbrook before they sell out, and hope that you have the right rail and the time and energy to dial in your skis. As Homer Simpson would say,
"Can't someone else do it?
Can't someone else do it? That's perfect."
It is kind of perfect. Pioneer Midwest is led by Matt Leipsch, who's not only a top 10 Berkey skier year in and year out, but also a Birchlegger. As of this year, so am I. Well, the Birchlegger, not the top 10 skier. And it might be mentioned every so often in the podcast. He and his team will make sure you have good skis. They won't win you the race. They might win him the race, not me. But they'll give you some good sleep and reduce your cortisol levels. That's worth it. Use the promo code podcast at pioneermidwest.com when you sign up so they know we sent you, and you'll get a few dollars off too. Speaking of a few dollars, this podcast has a Patreon, and I'm still using my last name, OFSEVIT, because that's how it was set up a long time ago. Patreon.com/offsevit, patreon.com/OFSEVIT. Go out and get those last big skis in before the race, and then cozy up to a warm stove and be glad that you're not running 100 miles, too. Or maybe aspire to run 100 miles if you haven't already. I'll take you up on a Main Street. So for those of you just joining us, we talked about this whole podcast, and some of the instructions got lost in the internet. And now we're doing it again. Hopefully to be a streamlined version. It's a little late on the East Coast, and we're getting this done. But talking to Jacob Wortman, Jacob has been on, this will be like the 10th time we've done a, 10th time I've done a Main Street podcast coming up. And I think you've been on every one of them, talk about your Berkey.
Yep.
19 Berkeys. And I've pointed out, I'm going to point out probably every podcast I do this season. This will be my 20th. Your 19th, you missed one. We did the first one together in 2006. Which was a while ago.
It was.
So I'm getting my purple bib this year, and you're not up for it next
correct.
Year.
Correct. Still upset about it, but we'll let it go, and we'll just get it on my 40th birthday. So
you're a year ahead of me, but you're behind me. I was looking at the statistics because, as I may have mentioned before, I'm doing my 20th Berkey this year.
Okay, good. You're doing better this time.
I may have mentioned that I'm going to be a Birchlegger this year. Was looking at some of the statistics. There's not a lot of folks who start right around 18, 19, and do their 20th when they're still in their 30s. So being in your early 40s is a pretty impressive feat.
Early longevity. 40s is the new 40s is the new 20s. I almost did that backwards.
A bit of backstory here. So for a number of years, I was in Chicago for summers, and I would fly up to Duluth. And I think the first time I came up just sort of hang out, you said, the night before the Voyager 50-miler, you said, "Hey, do you want to do a 50-mile race tomorrow? The weather's going to be reasonably nice. Do you want to do that?" I'm like, "Not really. I'm not really ready, but sure, why not?" And I made it 40 miles, and something went twang in my knee, and I got a ride in the back of a pickup to the start. But I made it back, and I ran the full 50 miles the next 2 years. Really nice race. Just sort of an old school race, great aid, great support, fun course out and back. You cross over yourself at one point, in Duluth. So you're sort of running through the the woods and then by a river and by a dam and over railroad tracks and into the city. In the summer, it's usually hot, sometimes smoky. But you've done that a number of times. Finally won it this year?
So I finally won it this year. It was my 6th or 7th time trying. It was smoky and hot. And I always say this year's my last year. And now since I finally won it, I think I can finally say that this year is my last year. It's a really cool race. Like you said, old school. You can sign up 3 days before. You know, it's unique in that regard. The only problem with it is it's always in the middle of the summer. And it's always the only hot weekend we typically have here in Duluth, Minnesota.
It's a race that I was able to do. I think I got lucky the years that I did it. It was not brutal, but there have been some years where it's just bad.
Brutal? Yeah. Brutal is kind of nice is the exception. Yeah. Brutal is the rule. So
I've done that race a couple times, and then we had a pandemic, some might remember. And during that pandemic, I was putting a lot of miles in. Because I had nothing better to do. It was in some contests, some Strava things, a lot of 20, 30-mile days. And at the end of the summer, a friend of mine said, hey, there's a 100-mile race that has a couple slots opened up. You want to do that? I looked at my training log, and I said, well, I haven't been training anything, but I inadvertently trained for a 100-mile race. Sure. So I ran a 100-miler, did pretty well, finished. It was crosses the state of Massachusetts, north to south, finished just under 24 hours, really pushed in at the finish. Not that hard of a course. It has a lot of roads in the second half, but the last few miles is this nasty, rocky trail. Similar to what you might see in Superior, but maybe more rocks on that portion. The next year, that same friend said, hey, I'm going to do Superior. You want to go out and do Superior? And I say, oh, I like Superior. I have a friend out in Superior, probably pace me. Called you up, you said you paced me, and I flew out and ran Superior. I ran a pretty good race. The first half I did 11 hours, I was feeling great, but it had gone up to 77 degrees during the day. At one point I ran out of water, my electrolytes get out of balance, and you can do a 50 miler and sort of finish respectably that way. If you try to then go another 50 miles overnight and you're not taking in carbohydrates well because your electrolytes are all out of balance and you're pissing it all through. You joined me for some struggles, and we persevered. I still finished 12th place overall in 28 hours and fell asleep in your car. You described it as the dumbass duathlon.
So I biked 40 miles to come meet you, and then I ran 42 miles with you.
Overnight, and so, picked up your bike. I fell asleep in the car.
Overnight.
And then we went out and got a beer, and there were people still running the race because 100 milers are crazy.
Correct. Yes. The highlight is, and my kids still remind me of this, is as soon as we got back to my house, you fell asleep on the hood of my car. So
I don't remember
really
that
we did that this recording, because I definitely wanted to flag that for your listeners.
Yeah,
you did.
Funny you thing about not sleeping overnight and on the hood expending of my car, yourself so. Energy for 100 miles is that it's not great for. I was very happy to have a ride home.
Yeah,
there's definitely a lot of crossover between the cross country ski community and the ultra community, but 100 milers are special, and some of the other things that get even longer. It's a special breed. So, you know, marathon's marathon. You go out, everyone sort of knows, okay, the fast people do it in 2 or 3 hours, but folks take 5 or 6. It's sort of like the Berkey. 50Ks, okay, well, you're going to go out and do it on some nice ski trails. 50 miler is, you know, you described as a work day, you know, a fast person will go out and do that 7, 8 hours, and sometimes some of the folks might put in overtime, but usually you wake up and you run the race, and then the sun goes down and you have a beer and go to sleep. 100 milers turn that on its head. And what got you to decide that you wanted to run 100?
So I promised myself that I would never do it, because you're right, it's a difference between a work day and a full day. And you know, we had 2 bad snow winters, and I think I was just looking for something to look forward to. So I put my name, and with this race, you know, you got to sign up 9 months in advance. So it's far enough away that you don't have that immediate, like, oh crap, right? Like it's something that's so far away, you can't even imagine doing it. So that made it easy. And then it just got closer and closer until it came. But sometimes I won't forgive myself for signing up, because now I've kind of gotten addicted, and I've gotten that bug. So it was something I was never going to do, and now it's like, oh, I can see doing 1 or 2 of these a year.
You got the genie out of the bottle.
Yeah, it's a weird, it's a strangely addicting thing. It's just like I Like I just like I said, it's fun. There's something about it that just the community, just kind of pushing yourself to that limit. It was a unique experience, and I gotta go do it again.
My first one was 24 hours. My superior was 28 hours. I had a decent race at Superior, despite sort of crashing the second half, finished 12th out of, you know, over 100 finishers. You did a little better than that. How was your time, and how was your finishing place?
Yeah, so I won it in right above 20 hours, I think 2010, 2012.
You could have found 12 minutes on that course, I bet.
Maybe it was 2015. I don't remember. It's one of those weird things. You know your marathon time, but I guess I should know my 100-mile time.
It's so like 20-ish hours. That's what you know.
20-ish hours. Yeah. Low 20s. Somewhere around there. 20XX. Won it. And it was kind of... I had that in the back of my mind that I could win it. My A goal was right around 20 hours. So I was able to hit both of those. And, you know, some of it was just like... I felt like it'd be easier to run it in 20 hours than it would be in 26. And so kind of like half jokingly, like I told my good friend, like, hey, here's what I'm going to do. I'm either going to break 20 or I'm going to go over 28.
Crash and burn, yeah.
Exactly. And I think doing it right around 20, like that was perfect. I don't think I could have found much more time out there. So I think I did it very smart. People went out really, really fast this year. My heart rate was like over 160 for the first 10 miles, which is not sustainable. And like I was pretty nervous because there was no way I was holding that pace. But I just stuck to the game plan, just raced the race that I knew I could do. And if other people were going to run it that fast, there was nothing I could do to stop them. Thankfully, none of them could. So I was able to reel everybody back in. But that was kind of a scare, like, oh boy, is it going to be this hard and is it going to hurt this much? The answer was no, but it's still going to hurt a lot. So.
And this Piers Trail is, you know, it's not a trail where you can cruise fast on, but the start of it is ski trails and some easier bits of trails before it gets technical. What's the Superior 100 miler like?
So it's technical. It's a great race for somebody that comes from the skiing background and has some of those strength, dexterity already developed. And because it's rocky, it's rooty, it's technical, it's not super runnable. Boardwalks, bridges, scrambling up climbs, short punchy elevation. In Minnesota, so everybody's like, well, it must be flat. Like, no, it's got 15K of vert elevation gain. And I looked at that's what I had in my Strava, so I think that's what we'll go with. So like it isn't like a continuous climb like you have it somewhere like Leadville where you go up for 2,000 feet and then you come down, right? You go up 20 feet, you go down 5, you go up 30 feet, you go down 40, right? Like it's just this punchy, relentless trail that really is always trying to grab you, always trying to trip you, and always trying to stub your toe.
Well, and that's the other thing is like, you know, you do a race like Leadville, and I paced the one at Leadville, and it's out and back, so we're in that whole trail. There's a few rocks and roots to jump over, but you sort of hike up 2 miles and 2,000 feet up a mountain, and then you have a nice cruisy single track, buffed out downhill. You can run down at if you're going fast, a nice fast mile, and then you do that for a few miles, then you go up again. This one, there's no rhythm to it. There's a lot of, you know, anytime you can't run fast down some of the hills because there's rocks and roots and logs and all things you're jumping down. I don't remember that much from the from this race, especially at night, but I do remember just one place where it's like, I knew we had a downhill. I was feeling okay. And it's like, oh, but now, you know, my legs are tired. And now I have to go down a bunch of like 2 foot high steps. And that's
correct.
Not...
Yeah. And there's some, the river crossings are the scariest. And it's not the river crossing, it's getting down because a lot of them, because of the geology up there, they're scouring through bedrock. And you've got these very short kind of like drops down to the river. So you're basically going down a ladder, then going back up a ladder. And you just have that kind of constant boom 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 every 2, 3, 4 miles where you're getting that stuff, and there's no way to establish this consistent rhythm that you see like a Javelina or a Leadville where you can just cruise and turn your brain off. Like, no, if you turn your brain off, you're gonna end up on your face, and it's gonna hurt.
I'm looking at your splits now, and your first few miles were in the eight, nine, you know, you were sort of 8 to 9 minutes up through mile 20, and then you go 12, 11, 10. There are a couple of faster miles in there on some of the, you know, some of the easier bits, but it's a lot of 12, 13 minute miles. You're a, what's your marathon, 230 something marathoner?
Yeah.
And so this is definitely slower than you're used to.
Oh yeah, for sure. And, but like, you know, it's all different. And really the key there, like if you look at some of the segments that I hit kind of towards like the Finland area, like that's where I was flying. If anywhere I was going fast, this was actually between Finland and Crosby is where like I just started to hammer because I felt good. The temperature was coming down, you know, night was coming. I wanted to go meet my wife who was pacing me. So that was like, cause I knew I'd meet her and Crosby and then we'd have kind of a good rhythm going. But to your point, like it's very hard to get a rhythm, very hard to do that. And that's why I think it suits skiers much more than other races.
Yeah. And so you started out, you know, certainly not in the lead and then sort of slowly picked people off as you got towards the end of the race.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Because people, like I said, people started out hot and I was like, oh, I can't do this. And I know what I'm capable of. Like, I really need to just follow my plan. And I did that, executed. And then people came back to me. I passed the first and second place person between like mile 55 and 60. And I passed it while my wife was pacing me, which I thought was really cool because there's nothing like, you know, young woman's out there just super peppy, super happy, and just kind of like driving the dagger in. Like,
yeah. And your like, wife's not the world's, you know, she's a fast runner, but she's pretty diminutive.
Yeah, she's not big, definitely. So like it was really fun. I really enjoyed running with her. I had a great crew. Eric Norgren, my wife, Emily Wartman, and then my friend Tyler Kablarschik. Like he's a great runner. He's done the Superior 50, he's got the record there, he's got the record in the Margie Duathlon, which is a 50-mile bike and a 50-mile run. My wife is very fast in her own right, and then Eric's got, you know, 800 or 900 mile finishes under his belt. So like great crew, like they made it really awesome. Parents came, you know, a whole bunch of other friends were out there, but they were really the key core group that really saw me through kind of from the start to the end. So
you had people like meeting you at most.
They were essentially just kind of just following me along, just always 8 miles ahead of me. And like it's a super cool community. John Storkamp, the race director, puts on a phenomenal race. Like there's a great number of people come up to volunteer from the Twin Cities, from Duluth, and so it's a pretty special community and a really cool event that again just inspires you to just like do it again because of the community and because it's a uniquely fun, painful experience.
And this is one of the, you know, the ultra racing really only got started in the late 70s, early 80s. This is really one of the first races. It's remained one of the big races, especially outside of sort of the West where a lot of the mountain races happen.
Yeah, I think it was, it started in 1991. So 1991, and I think it's the ninth oldest 100-mile trail race in the nation.
Yeah, and looking at it, the trail was really only was, portions were open in the 80s and it was only halfway done in 1990. So really the trail and the race dovetailed together. You sort of passed these runners, you got out ahead of them. You probably had some splits off them, but now you're ahead. How does it feel running a race? It's at night, you have pacers. What's it like to sort of be leading a race like that, you know, in your first 100 hour?
Yeah, the physical challenge of Superior was somewhat daunting, but I felt ready. Coming from a ski background, coming from a running background, like it was just about being durable, just being able to endure that kind of, you know, low zone two kind of effort for 20 hours.
Yeah.
But really, so kind of like leading the race, like, so the physical piece, like that's fine. We're doing well. Yeah. 90 miles in, body starts breaking down, but really wasn't until 90 that it was like, oh, okay, this hurts a lot. But like the mental piece and just like the running scared piece, like particularly in that forest at night, like you're just, I'm always like, okay, who's behind me? And like, how far are they behind me? It's dark. Like, you know that forest. Like, it is.
Yeah.
It is dark. And so, like, you can see light when it's shining because there aren't artificial lights in very many places. So, like, there's something creepy about that. And actually, I skied last weekend up at Sugar Bush, which is in right along the Spearhead Trail where this race takes place.
You run through it, those trails, I think.
Correct. I did it at night, and it was terrifying. like, it was just scary. There's something about those woods. And like, that's one of the reasons that I couldn't do that race without a pacer, because I think I would creep myself out because of how dark and just kind of scary they are. So to answer your question, like, you're literally running scared, and you're just kind of running scared because sometimes those forests can be creepy at night. So...
And then you finished the race at 4 in the morning. The last few aid stations you came through, they must have just sort of been opening up, and maybe were you surprised some folks coming into them?
Those aid station workers and the aid station captains, volunteers, like, they're there, like, through the end of it, which, you know, depending on where you are in the cutoff, like, you can be there till, like, 8 p.m. So if you're there starting at, you know, midnight, that's... you're almost doing a full day yourself. So some of the last three, when we came through, they were just getting things started, because, you know, also for them, like, it's kind of a lame time to, they're tired, right? There's only one of me versus when the 50 milers come through, when the marathoners come through, and then when the majority of the 100 racers come through, like, that's really when the party starts for them. So it's more it's a little bit like hi, you're here, and, you know, everybody's very Minnesotan, so super friendly, but also, yeah, like, sometimes they're not expecting to see somebody you know, run out of the woods at 2 a.m. or whatever.
Well, and you're all business there, right? You're getting in, you're getting your aid, whatever you need, and you're getting out.
I'm not very much fun. Yeah. Like, I was really excited because they have such good food, and I was going to eat all this great stuff. And, well, it turns out I ate nothing. I did the typical skier runner thing where, you know, you show up to the hotel and you eat a packet of ketchup, and you make a meal out of, you know, being kind of the thrifty folks that we are. Like, I ended up just using all my own nutrition. So I took in over 4 pounds of like high scratch carbohydrate mix. And like, that's really kind of what I did. Supplemented it with some gels, but I couldn't get the dry stuff down. It just had to be liquid, which worked great for me. I averaged about 100 grams of carbohydrates an hour, which kind of equates to right around 9,000 calories. And like, my Coros, like, I was still in quite the deficit. So, the aid stations are great. It's super fun. I only wish I was able to take in more solid foods.
And, you know, and then the other thing about this race is that it has a 38-hour cutoff. It starts at 8 a.m. It had this year 176 finishers. I'm looking at the results, and 32 of them finished under 28 hours. The first 8 hours had someone coming through every 15 minutes, but the next 10 hours had 150. So it's like four times as many people, or five times as many people coming through per hour.
Yeah.
So yeah, the aid stations are set up for like multiple people there, and pacers and crews, and you're just coming through with a pacer, coming in for a couple minutes, grabbing what you need, and zooming back off into the night. Some of these are really set up with lights and all sorts of things.
Yeah, they go all out, and they put on a pretty good show. So it's you know, it's kind of like the Berkey sometimes. It's like, do I really want to be as competitive as I've been, or do I want to have fun? And there's some truth to that, and just kind of like enjoying the experience and kind of celebrating the activity. So
there's something to be said for getting to bed before it gets light, which is pretty rare for an ultra. Yeah. I know the friend who had told me about Superior, he was sort of on the edge of normal in an ultra race. In this race, he's done a number of them. When we were running through the woods, you kept checking in on him, and he hadn't moved for about 6 hours. He hadn't gotten to the next aid station, which is the only way to track people in a race like this. You know, with the Berkey, if you're tracking his competitor, Maybe it's an hour for some of the slower skiers between aid stations. But in an ultra race, it can be 2 or 3 hours if you're not moving that fast and it's the middle of the night. Mm-hmm. But after 7 hours, we saw him pop up at the next aid station. He went about 10 miles during that time. I'm like, boy, he's having a rough time. But, you know, a few minutes later, he was at the next one, which is a few miles down the trail. And then he had a good race. He actually worked his way back through the second half of the race. I asked him what happened. He's like, oh, that was one of the darker places I've been 100. Mm-hmm. I just lay down in some leaves next to the trail and fell asleep for a few hours. But I got up and I felt great and finished the race. And that's sort of almost a more normal experience to have during an ultra race than what you did, which is like run your race to your plan and finish and feel okay.
Yeah, and like I've got the utmost respect for people that can do that, because it's not that they're trying any less hard, and they're doing that for
twice as long,
almost 100% more than I did. And so I have, you know, it's always like, they're like, oh man, how'd you do that? And I'm always like, how'd you do that? Yeah. Right? Like, nothing I did was harder than what you did. And actually, it was probably easier, because, boy, at 4 a.m., I was able to stop and lay down, and you still had 35 miles left. Like, I you know, respect, and like the mental kind of fortitude that takes is pretty cool. So I always, you know, I don't look at myself as like being better. Like I'm able to go a little bit quicker, and it actually makes it easier. So yeah. I think that's really cool, and that's one of the reasons that I do this sport and I stay in the community is because of that, and just because of how people just, you know, they enjoy it. They get to challenge themselves, and that at the end of the day, it's like, be better than the person you were yesterday, which I think is cool.
Yeah, when you're racing that race in September, the sun goes down, mm-hmm. about 7:30. You see the sun go down. You run for a number more hours. You stay up, mm-hmm. most of the night, but then you crash into a bed and get some sleep, or, you know, what I did, which was run into the next morning and then crash in your car, another put of your car, and eventually get some sleep. Yeah. Some folks run through the entire next day, see the sun go down again, and then finish. I am very impressed by that. That's not something I think I'd want to do again.
No.
And I'm probably some steps away from my next 100 as well. But
some of them then, like, go get in a car and then drive 4 hours. So, yeah.
That's a choice. So at the end of the race, so your kids were at home.
They were at home. Yep. So yeah, I had, like I said, my crew, Emily, Tyler, and Eric, and the kids were at home, grandparent, and I think I will be doing it here again in 2026. You know, it's one of those things. I'll have to share the meme with you. I'm very conscious about doing this, like, with me, right? Like, this isn't something I'm gonna hold my family to doing, right? Like, I enjoy it, I get to do it, I'm not gonna hold them hostage to it, because there's a great meme that, like, you know, it's the vacation that you want, right? And everybody's on a nice sandy beach and they're having a fun time versus the vacation that you got, and it just shows, like, a dad, like, curled up over a camping chair, obviously in running attire, and then his family just kind of standing around him, just kind of, you know, looking bored because they're just following their dad doing that. And so I'm always very cognizant about kind of doing it for me and just kind of let my family, like, if they want to come, that's cool. And like I said, my wife came up, that was awesome, but also definitely not pushing it on them in any way.
Yeah. And you were able to crash in a hotel and then get home the next morning, I bet.
Yeah. Yep. Sounds so nice. We finished, and then we all, the four of us, we had a room right next to the finish line, and we went and crashed for about 2 hours. I was pretty hyped up still on caffeine. Yeah. And then I came, I just kind of, you know, was milling around the finish area, but it's one of those things that, you know, like, wasn't a ton of people that had finished yet, and then a lot of times when they do, they're too tired, they just want to go crash too. So I will be smarter this year about just how to approach the finish line and how to have a good time afterwards.
There is only so much you can do when you've run 100. Well, it's actually a little more than 100, isn't it? How are those last few miles?
Those last few miles are tough because it's not 100 miles, it's 103 miles, and there's nothing that quite hits as hard or hurts as bad as coming through the aid station at, I think 96 miles at Sugar Bush, and then seeing the 7 miles to go sign when your brain is saying, no, we only have 4 miles left. So that's tough to make it. Like, it's like no big deal. 3 miles, it's less than 3%. Ooh,
it's a 5K.
It's not. So no,
it's a downhill 5K.
It is not. It is a tear-filled swear word fest is what it was for me. So
yeah.
I felt bad. Eric and Emily were the ones that were pacing me at that time, and I had to apologize to them after because my behavior was inappropriate.
You never really have to apologize to your pacers after. You know, you feel the need to, but they got into it. They kind of know.
It's just, I was a blubbery mess. And I just like, is that where your mind goes? Because you're so depleted. You're so tired. And like, you can't process anything. So then you sign up for it again, I guess.
So you're going to do this next year because you're mm-hmm. masochist or just for fun?
Yeah. So like you can ask your wife, you talk to my wife, like it's the same thing I think with pregnancy, right? Where you're able to like section that off and break off the part about how painful and how hard specific things were, just because like, you know, you get a kid and for the 100 miles, like you get to experience that like awesome community
and you get a nice those sweatshirt
things and you get a great sweatshirt, and so you block those bad things out, and then by January when the lottery opens, can you say, yeah, that sounds like a good idea? And you know what's going to happen in September? I'm gonna cuss myself and say, gosh darn it, January Jacob, why were you so stupid and why did you sign me back up for this? And then January Jacob will probably forget that and sign up for it again. So
do you think you'll look into doing any of the other big 100-milers in the country?
And that's a good question. I looked, and, you know, it's hard. So I'm here in Minnesota. We're not at elevation.
Yeah.
A lot of those Western races are at elevation. I don't necessarily have the time to get acclimated or spend kind of the necessary, you know, yeah, I still like to be competitive. And for me to do well at those races, that would take kind of a significant time investment. Even like if you look at Western states, like you get up around 8,000, 9,000 feet. And like there's definitely a altitude component where if you don't have that, it's going to be tough. So right now, like I did look at some and I just know there are some other ones that are lower that are potentially even out east. Like I think some of the ones out east would be cool just because of the mm-hmm. type of terrain that they're on.
Yeah.
But at this point, it's super easy. Superior literally starts 35 miles north of my house. So I just sometimes press the easy button. And it, like I said, the community is great. John puts on a fantastic race. And that's why it's just like, I think I'll just go do that again.
It's a great race. You don't have to get an airplane, so why not?
Exactly. And I feel like there's going to be a real fast crew out there this year. And I feel like I've learned a lot that I can potentially apply. And hopefully, dream for me would be dipping under 19 hours. So, you know, taking an hour and a half off sounds ridiculous, but think it could be doable, particularly if like we've got a cool group of guys going after it next year
and some cool weather.
That's key. Yep.
Now this is a Berkey podcast, and I you know, there's definitely some crossover between these communities. I was at the start of this race, 7:45, everyone's sort of groggy mm-hmm. getting ready for the race, and someone goes, looks at my bib, oh, you're the Berkey podcast guy. And so, you know, made that connection. But how does this mm-hmm. How does help prepare you for the Berkey? What have you learned? Anything you learned, especially about nutrition from this for the Berkey? I know it's a very different length of race, different intensity, but you know, looking forward to the race in a few weeks where you'll be doing your 19th, I'll be doing my 20th, just in case anyone was wondering.
There's just kind of the general fitness that like you just keep stacking bricks, right? Like gotta stack bricks, and you just kind of you use what you've created over your lifetime. So there's that. I think that the biggest learning thing that I will take, and it is kind of hard with a race like the Berkey because there's so many pack dynamics, is just, you know, just being, just trusting your training, like trusting like what you've done and like for me, I don't take training. I don't have a spreadsheet. I don't have a coach. Yep. I have a general approach, right? That works for me. And I do that. And trusting your fitness, kind of like being true to what your fitness is and not trying to do something you can't, right? Like, don't try to win the first 5K. That's what I realized at Superior. Like, hey, if I do the race I know I can do, I can do the best I can. And whatever other people do, great. And so that's really how I'm going to approach the Berkey this year. Like, I'll know where my fitness is. I know what I'll be capable of. And if other people are better than that, awesome for them. I can only, you know, control what I can control. So yeah, just really focusing on what I can control. And then outside of that, you know, other stuff will be as it will be. And again, it's all about having fun at this point.
Get yourself to Main Street, and it's always going to be fun to get on Main Street, whether you win the sprint there or was it.
The Olympic team was named, and I saw I was not on it again. So I think my chances are getting slimmer and slimmer, and I think I'm okay with that.
You know, I know you're right on the edge this year again.
Again.
Fifth Olympics in a row.
Yeah, fifth Olympics. Yeah, it's since Turin in 2006. So yeah,
since that first Torino. Berkey.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, it's back in Italy. Shoot. And, you know, you could fly to Italy, miss the Berkey. But
I could. I could.
Yeah. And yeah, I guess we're less than 4 weeks from the Berkey. So you any exciting plans, or just sort of another Berkey down this year?
Yeah, just another Berkey down. As we kind of like talked about earlier, like the results are, I think the numbers are just going to continue to grow.
You're not going to win.
I'm not going to win. I'm turning 40 next year for my 20th Berkey. I don't turn 40 on the Berkey, but I will be 40 during the Berkey next year. No, I think it's just, you know, I've enjoyed it. Again, a really cool community. It's actually like probably, and maybe this is for you, but I bet it's for a lot of your listeners, like the most constant thing in my life.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Yep. Like, so many things have changed. I've, you know, went to college, went to grad school, moved to Oklahoma,
finished in like 400th place when you were in Oklahoma.
I did finish, but lost a mother-in-law, had kids, like dogs, like just so many changes. And the one constant through all of that has always been the Berkey. And like, there's nothing else like that. Even other races, like I've done the Voyager a bunch, I've done Grandma's Marathon, I've done Twin Cities, but it's never the same constant year in and year out. So I really appreciate that. And like, regardless of whether I'm winning, regardless of if I'm the top 50 elite wave, whatever, like it's a constant for me, and something that, you know, I think tradition is important, and having those things is really, really important. So
and building that community that you have with the Flying Standing Races, really build that up. And you get a sweatshirt. It's like getting the bib at the Berkey. It's like, it's not that exciting. It's a really nice sweatshirt, but wear it proudly.
And I think it's important to you know, have your communities these days. And now more than ever, it's important to just focus on kind of what's important, and just advocating for it and fighting for it. So I will definitely, I'll be there, even if it gets $250 for an entry fee. Like, I get it. They have the needs to keep funding and keep building a great race and kind of a great organization. So
supporting a good cause and benefiting from a good cause.
Exactly. Yep. So we're big. We're in Cable at least 3 or 4 times a year. It's a great place. The Berkey really helps provide a lot of opportunities for that area, bring in a lot of tourism. So, we love the area, and really, I think it traditionally in Minnesota, you go north to the cabin. You know, here we go south to Wisconsin for kind of our cabins. Yeah. So,
well, I'll see you in Cable, and I'll see you in Hayward.
Sounds good.
Well, thanks, Jacob, and good luck on that purple bib next year. Ha 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 ha. And good luck getting the second patch for the Superior sweatshirt. And another belt buckle, I guess. Ultras have an interesting sense of style. I fully expect Jacob to dust me on the race course in a couple weeks. And a 2-digit purple bib may be in his future, putting him in good company with last year's Birchlegger Top 100 skiers, Adam Swink and Matt Liebsch,
who might have a one-digit bib and also runs Pioneer Midwest, which is offering a discount for the Race Wax service. If you use the code PODCAST when you sign up at their website, pioneermidwest.com, as we mentioned in the intro. And once again, we have a Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/offsevit if you want to support my podcast production addiction, or at least make it more of an addiction. I might actually buy a mic for the lake this year. We'll be back with more podcasts before race day, and I even have some lined up for after the race as well. So we will be back in your ears soon.